Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Extra Rounds podcast. As always, my name is Mike Dice.
I'm Elias.
And we are here to talk about all things MMA, recap UFC 216. Great. And then at 2:20 or 20 minutes after the hour, I don't know which time zone you're watching from, Devin Clark, UFC fighter, Jackson Wink fighter, will call in to talk about his upcoming fight in 10 days. 10 days from today, yeah, actually. But first of all, card. Happy birthday.
Thanks, Mike.
So for those of you who don't know, it's Elias's birthday. So any big plans to celebrate?
I think I'm going to have some ramen tonight and a bowl of poke. I think a rice bowl. So that pretty much is the big exciting plan. It's been good for me. I've been actually cutting down the last 4 days, kind of arbitrarily what I've been eating. So today I'm going to treat myself. I already started. My wife made a cheesecake. She makes amazing cheesecake. I ate like half of it this morning. This is after like 4 days, Mike, of eating like water, protein shakes, and nuts and fruit. And then I just had like half a cheesecake. Gonna have two bowls for dinner tonight. So I'm pretty excited.
Sounds like an awesome way to spend a birthday.
Yeah, I'm lucky.
And spending it here with us. So
yeah, absolutely.
Till Devin Clark calls in at 20 minutes past, we're going to just basically talk. So if you have any questions, feel free to drop them into the chat, and we will do our best to answer them. Otherwise, we'll just talk about UFC 216 and everything that happened this weekend. So
plenty to talk about there. Did you see that I spoke to both of the main eventers' coaches?
I did. I saw on Flow Combat. You talked to the coaches of both of them, and they gave interesting perspective. So make sure to go check that out. That was a pretty cool thing.
Thanks, man.
Definitely unique perspective. Something, you know, everybody... It's a rush to hear what the fighter thinks, but the coaches are often more silent in this sport than other sports.
And they pick up the phone more readily the night of or the day after a fight than fighters. So it's useful, and it's
they're less burnt out. They haven't had the adrenaline dump that fighters have had.
Not quite as much.
So anyways, Devin Clark calling in. But let's focus about Demetrius Johnson right now.
Oh, man.
He set the record for title defenses with a win. In the fifth round, he submitted Ray Borg via armbar in perhaps the craziest submission you will ever see. I think John Morgan of MMA Junkies dubbed it the Mouse Trap, which is a fun name for it. If it was wrestling, that would be a very fitting name because it would be on point with the gimmick.
Yeah.
But definitely something surreal, something that I don't know that I've ever seen. For those of you who missed it, he did what could only be described as a German suplex. And then in midair, transitioning into a armbar, so that by the time Borg had kind of realized he had been slammed, he was already in an armbar. It was incredible to watch. Demetrius Johnson retweeted something from one of the UFC Twitter accounts that has it in slow motion. So check it out. But you know, you're a guy who practices the sport, jiu-jitsu at least. What did you think of this?
And MMA for sure.
And MMA.
Just at a very low level.
Right.
But yeah, I've been fighting that for like 7 years now. And it's something that we were talking about that, Mike. Like, if we were, it was actually the next day at the gym at Foundation, we were talking. It was like, man, if we were all to just get together right then and like just drill it, technique, no resistance. Just get belly to back, switch your then in midair, once you elevate your partner, release the your grips off of the waist and switch to the arm with no resistance over and over. If we did it for an hour, it would be hard to be that coordinated, right? If your partner was letting you. It's definitely something that I've personally never seen happen. I'm sure someone's seen it somewhere at some point. I've not seen it. And it's just the coordination to do it is just remarkable. To go from slamming someone to right into the armbar, it's pretty cool. And you know, Demetrius Johnson, I feel if not the best armbar in speaking broadly in MMA history, then it's certainly up there. I mean, it's so hard to get any type of straight armbar on someone in an MMA fight. It's hard to do it. It's hard to do it to good people in Roland. It's very hard to do it in jiu-jitsu competition. It's extremely hard to do it in an MMA fight unless there's a big skill gap between you and your partner. And at the highest level of MMA, any type of straight armor, I mean, let's think about it. Other than like old Hicks and Gracie and Ronda Rousey and Demetrius Johnson, we don't see straight arm locks of any type happen very often. It's, you know, fighters take pain and they might get cracked and they'll escape out. So to do it the way he did, and not just a straight armbar, which he's done now and several times against amazing opposition, but to do it like he did again in the last round off of a suplex, I mean, he's just It really. I think I agree with you, Mike. That it's probably the craziest. It might be that not only the craziest submission that I've seen, but the craziest like fight ending sequence I've seen at that level of MMA, or that I can remember. I can't remember one that strikes me more than that.
We are in the immediate aftermath, so it's really easy to be high on that one because it's so fresh.
It's so fucking hard to do, though.
Right. And it's a copycat sport. You know, somebody kind of does something and it adds a new wrinkle to the sport and other people are kind of quick to pick it up. It makes you wonder, though, like the creativity to think like the suplex isn't the end of the move. Like it can be used as a transition to see like what that kind of opens up that door, like people going forward. I don't think you can expect the next UFC card this weekend to see, you know, the next evolution of it. But it's interesting. I think people will start looking at ways to utilize it as more than just, you know, slamming your opponent.
I think you're totally right. It is people, you know, once we see something work well, especially if it's not an esoteric move, right? It's two very fundamentally sound things done in conjunction in a timing that's astounding. So like people can do it. Like people, I wouldn't be surprised if everyone's drilling that. That's the way it happens. I remember after Anthony Pettis bounced off the wall, hit that what became dubbed maybe by John Morgan the Showtime kick. I don't know who did it, but Mousetrap is pretty funny. After he did that against Benson Henderson, we were all like, saying, let's test this cage strength and jump on the cage and like. People like me who have no coordination are just falling all over the place. But, you know, like everyone gets in the gym and tries stuff when it's crazy like that. Or the Ezekiel choke from, what's the gentleman, the big heavyweight, the Russian guy that hits it like every day he steps in the ring. And he hit it while he was mounted. The next day we're in there trying to figure out. Or when Tito Ortiz, and if you know the name, put it in the comments, guys. I'm bad with that. Tito Ortiz hit that choke off to the side of Chael Sonnen and in the gym figuring out the next day, like, how can you hit it from that angle? So, you're right, Mike. I'm sure everyone's drilling it. I'm sure everyone's working on that. No doubt.
Well, the jumping off the cage, I've seen it a couple people attempt it to less success than Anthony Pettis in the past. But also, you know, we've seen Jose Aldo do that thing where they back up and they put their foot on the cage and they jump off. Yeah. And Tony Ferguson, I think, did it in the Lando Venata fight too, which was in South Dakota, which Devin Clark connection there. But, you know, so it'll be interesting to see. But now the debate switches that he's set the record for title defenses. Is he the greatest MMA fighter of all time?
Well, I mean, you know, that's always a fun discussion. We can never know. And it's always a weird amalgam of skills, accomplishments, and other characteristics, more intangible. And you kind of put that melange together and come up with your own determination. I've, for a while now, thought that he needs to be in the discussion. If we're talking about pound-for-pound skills, I don't think there's a great argument that for anyone else being as well-rounded as he is, as excellent in so many areas, as apparently without big holes in their game as Demetrius Johnson, and that goes a long way, right? That's overall skill set. And then if you look at accomplishments, well, he's racking those up. There, you know, the more ignorant fans out there talk about there being a lack of competition of flyweight, and that's just absurd. They have some of the best athletes in the world at flyweight. He's making
it's a lazy thing because there's
very lazy
because he was the first champion.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, he's the first champion in the UFC, and we've had 125ers for many years that are great. Again, if they just don't know their history, they don't know their history. But if you look at like the people he beats, they're amazing. You know, he's beaten like his biggest closest rivals. He's beaten multiple times. Not like John Dodson or Joseph Benavidez, who's
only lost to Demetrius Johnson and Dominic Cruz.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, you know, really high level competition. So he's put together this streak of wins, this streak of title defenses. I mean, the only person the last person to arguably beat him in that weight class is Ian McCall when they had their inaugural bat on that the judging was weird and they kind of got screwed and had to do a rematch. Ever since then, no one's really looked great for a whole fight against or even competitive for a whole fight against Demetrius Johnson. People can give him problems for or things to adjust to, but yeah, if you look at his accomplishments, they're there. It's a shame that Anderson Silva doesn't have 11 because he deserves that. Travis Luter didn't make weight, and that's why he doesn't have 11, even though he beat Travis Luter. But there's any way you cut it, Demetrius Johnson is all time in terms of skill level, all time in terms of accomplishments, in terms of, you know, being up there in a discussion, and then all sorts of fun little intangible things like, man, the pace he keeps, how consistent he keeps in a fight, Mike, and how he he can finish so late in a fight. There's a threshold usually, like if a fight hasn't been finished in many fights between most fighters by a certain point, especially a five rounders, usually it'll go to the decision. There's so much fatigue. There's so, you know, these guys are and girls are so good and they're so evenly matched. It's tough to break someone down methodically and eventually like really break through at the end of it. You know, it's game winning shots aren't as common in fighting as they are in you know, in basketball and stuff like that, or walk off home runs. So he's, I think he has like 3 third round submission wins now. Like he, 3 fifth round submission wins. Like he makes adjustments well in there, even when guys challenge him. He'll win in different ways when someone shuts down one part of his game. I think there's an excellent argument that he's the best of all time. If you think there's someone else in there, there's plenty of other great arguments out there to be had with other guys and girls. But I think he needs to be in that discussion. I think he needs to be in the discussion for the last 2 years, personally. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the most interesting things after his fight was that him talking about wanting to kind of beat Ray Borg at Ray Borg's game. And he seems to do a lot of that. You know what I mean? You know who else was like that? George St. Pierre. St. Pierre was, and he kind of touched on this in the Bisping press conference. He's working with a boxing coach because that's Bisping's strength. And we've seen him do things like that in the past over the course of his career. He's underappreciated, most artists, but you know, he's wants to extend the record, at least that's what Dana Light I think alluded to this weekend. I'm remembering all the comments that happened, but you know, and if he just keeps running that total up, it's, you know, to a point where it's almost unfathomable that it'll ever be reached. You know, I think that would do enough. You know, the Cody Garbrandt or TJ Dillashaw coming down challenging, I think would only further cement it.
Sure, those would be fun challenges. Absolutely, him going up, I know none of us mentioned it, but I know everyone's talking about, is he gonna go up? He's gonna go up. Well, he's been up there. He became the number one contender at bantamweight, fighting people that were much bigger than him, and he lost a decision to Dominic Cruz. So, you know, just for those to kind of like address, you know, well, I don't know what people are saying in the comments, but I know I've seen some things out there. Even a lot of the questions he gets are like, hey, are you gonna fight up at bantamweight? Maybe these guys will come down to him, but are you going to fight up in bantamweight? Listen, maybe he will, maybe he won't. I think he's right in demanding actual professional athlete money to do it, but he's done it already. Like I've seen a lot of folks on discussion forums say, like, you know, Anderson Silva, and listen, you can think Anderson Silva is better or more accomplished, that's fine. There's no real reason for me to disagree with you. But Anderson went up to light heavyweight, you know, so his streak, you know, his accomplishments are better. Well, Demetrius Johnson went up to bantamweight. He did more than go up to it like Anderson did. He campaigned there, and he got up to a title shot. He went the distance with the champion. So it's okay to have a different opinion of who's the best of all time, but it's definitely not okay to, like, underappreciate him like you say he is being currently.
Well, let's talk about Tony Ferguson. Yeah. Impressive performance. Beats Kevin Lee in the third round to win the interim lightweight title. What were your takeaways from that fight?
Yeah, that was interesting. He fought really well off his back. He made interesting adjustments. He worked. He put to use on the ground so much of what he works with Eddie Bravo in camp. And on the feet, I'm sure he put to use what he worked with. With his striking coaches on the feet, because he did really well standing up as well for most of the fight. But, you know, like Eddie Bravo, when we spoke to him earlier this week for this article, we spoke to him and Robert Fallis, who is Kevin Lee's coach, one of his coaches. Eddie talked about setting, when you're on your back, they expected one to be on their back, which is interesting. Tony Ferguson is a great wrestler, but they figured, hey, we're going to be on our back. They considered this, Mike, like they said, like a second Khabib Nurmagomedov camp. They said, hey, listen, very similar risks, right? Maybe a big shot on the feet, but mostly takedowns, passing, maybe back control. We're worried about that, and then ground strikes. So they worked off, they were ready to work off their back. They expected to. And Tony used timing so well. He used elbows to set up the triangle. Like he worked, like Eddie pointed out, he worked for this armbar earlier in the round, I believe, in third round. Lee got out of it. He set it up with no strikes. He just went for the armbar. It was a great armbar. When he went for the triangle, he basically gave Kevin Lee the options of, when he had his feet up in his hips, he gave Kevin Lee the options of retreating, standing up, and posturing up, and going back to the feet, where maybe he didn't feel he had such a great shot with Tony Ferguson, who's a long or great boxer. Or he was going to just posture up in that stand, then he was susceptible to elbows. And at that point, he kind of collapses back down and loses the posture. When you lose your posture, you're susceptible to things like a triangle choke. So the way he used strikes off of his back to set up submissions off of his back is amazing. And let's keep in mind, this guy is supposed to be a wrestler. A wrestler that comfortable off their back is super impressive. And any fighter at that level, at being able to finish off their back. And to finish a guy like Kevin Lee off your back is pretty crazy. Make no mistake about it, and I'm sure Eddie Bravo will disagree with this, being on your back is not a good place to be in a fight as a rule. It's very difficult. The guy and a girl on top has to do like one half thing half right to hurt you, like a little elbow gets through and you got to do a lot of things right to get up or submit someone. And Tony Ferguson really showed some cool advancements in ways that, like, Kenny Florian used to set up things off his back with elbows, like when he hit Joe Lozon with a choke. Like, a lot of people don't do that. They just grapple, then they strike, or they wrestle, then they grapple on the ground. And he combined all those things really, really seamlessly. He took damage off the bat. That's the only worry, is that, like, in this hugely dominant streak that Tony Ferguson has going, is there's been a couple moments and a couple fights that he ended up dominating, and all of which where he gets hurt. And I'm just worried that he won't get the big money fight before he's, you know, been tagged too many times. But in terms of that performance, pretty impressive, right? Like, he wasn't just a bigger dominant guy. He had to come from behind, he had to show a lot of different looks. Very interesting. And I thought Kevin Lee fought well too. He's a young dude. I don't see any reason why he can't come back.
Kevin Lee tagged him a few times.
Yeah. And you heard him bad.
Yeah, which makes you wonder how the Tony Ferguson Conor McGregor fight would go if that came to fruition. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other debate.
No, it's very interesting. He'll probably get hit. Like, it'll be how he reacts to it. Yeah.
Do you think he'll be tough enough to withstand Conor and his fabled power?
Yeah. I don't think Conor has more punching power than all the guys that he's faced. Conor does a lot of really good things. He's not George Foreman, though. In terms of punching power, like, it's not, he's an excellent striker, and he gets a lot of finishes because he does a lot of things well. It's not just like him beating a bull carcass, like that type of raw power. So, you know, none of these guys are in for an easy night if they let the other hit them on the chin clean more than twice. Like, either one could put the other out for sure. I think Tony Ferguson shows he can recover really well. Again, it's just at some point with that, do you get diminishing returns because you're taking abuse? But I think, you know,
that's the key.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, the gas tank. That's always been Connor's, like,
well, weak point. I think Tony Ferguson will definitely have superior conditioning if they go down. You know, I don't even know what I don't even criticize Conor McGregor for it. Like, I just think fighting is hard, and sometimes the other guy is less tired than you or responds to it better. So I don't even have like a point of criticism for him. But I think Tony Ferguson has proven himself better into late rounds. And I know everyone likes to talk about the second fight with Nate Diaz and how he went five rounds. And he did, and that was a great fight with Conor McGregor. But I don't think he lost the second half of that fight, and I don't think he deserved the win. So, yeah, I think Tony Ferguson, if he doesn't get caught with something clean, I think he has a lot of ways to win that, Mike. I think he can hurt Conor on the feet. I think he could submit him. I think he could take him down. Like, I think it's a pretty good matchup as far as an extremely dangerous matchup goes. You're facing someone as great as Conor McGregor. As far as that goes, I think it's a pretty good matchup for Tony Ferguson. I bet he feels real good about that fight.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that whole situation plays out and whether or not Tony Ferguson will get the shot or whether or not this Nate Diaz trilogy will come to think. One interesting thing I just want to get out before we call Devin Clark, because it is 20 minutes after, is that I was thinking about this and all the talk. If Conor doesn't fight December 20th,
I hope they doesn't.
He's not fighting until March 17th. I think that's a lot of people, how active will he be? And I saw somewhere that he said he wouldn't get a fight till January, but I don't think he can. If things go according to plan, he could fight January and turn around and fight in March. But
fuck, I hope not. I think while you dial, I'll opine on that. Like, I just fucking hope not. This guy's gotten, let me see, we got two Diaz fights where he got either finished or hurt badly. He got stopped by Floyd. It's like 3 out of 4 fights he's gotten hurt. This guy needs to rest, man. I hope he waits till March, if not sooner.
Hello.
Hey, Devin, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to us and join the show.
Yeah, no worries.
How are things going for you this week? 10 days out from the fight.
They're going great. Just got back to South Dakota yesterday, putting the final touches on my camp. So, yeah, going good, hanging out with family. Just left the butterfly house. So,
what's the is that a normal thing since you've been down at Jackson Winks, going back home to South Dakota? You know, in between wrapping up training camp and the week of the fight.
I usually don't, but this time, since it's all the way in Poland, figured I'd come home, see my family first, and then head out.
Is it difficult to be away from your family in training?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think I was gone for, like, almost 7 weeks or 6 weeks, so that's – my daughter, she's about to be four, so, yeah, it's pretty hard.
Now, Devin, this is Elias here. Thanks again for being on the show. Never had a chance to chat with you earlier, but you actually fought near us not too long ago. You've had, I'm sure it doesn't feel quick to you. You're putting in the grind, but not too long ago, you were fighting in local Chicago shows. You fought at TFC. I remember seeing you there at that one, which is pretty cool. Have you been to Chicago since then at all?
I haven't. Oh. That was my last time being there and last time fighting there. But I remember that though. That was a fun fight. I remember I was really mad because the guy was talking a bunch of smack before the fight. So.
See, I never knew that. Yeah, you rushed him right from the start in that fight too. Like you went to Jose Aldo this guy off the bat with a flying knee, and that makes sense now.
Well, because I knew because he'd always come out like crawling and stuff and try to take that wrestler's approach, and I knew he couldn't strike very well, so. I just assumed he was just, as soon as I came at him like that, he was going to hit his knees, and he did, and I barely missed him with that knee.
But, that was pretty slick.
It was fun.
what got you interested in MMA to begin with? Had you watched it since you were a kid, or is there specific moments that made you want to get into it?
Pretty much when I was in junior college wrestling, some of the guys they'd practice it, just on the mats and stuff, and guys like Tommy Spear would come in. Ah. He was out that way in Minnesota. Tommy Spear and I'm forgetting his name now, but he has like 100 some fights. He's a heavyweight, but they would come in and practice and stuff. And so then when I was done wrestling, my dad's friend had just a little amateur team, and I went and checked it out and fell in love with it. Found out I was decent at it. So.
how supportive of mixed martial arts are people in South Dakota, would you say? Like, what's the scene like there? I've never visited.
It's a newer concept here. I think it just got legal tech, legit about, 3 years ago?
Mm.
And so before that, stuff wasn't sanctioned and stuff like that. So it's kind of a new thing around here, but people love the fact that there's a UFC fighter here now, and there's a couple guys that have they're from here. They're in the UFC. Ben Wynn's one of them. So, but yeah, they're picking up on it. And they love it. So, the RFA was coming here. I think they've done like 5 shows here, and pretty much every time they'd pack the house. So, it's been pretty good.
And you've actually fought in South Dakota a lot, especially on those RFA shows you mentioned. What was the home crowds like for you when you were fighting in South Dakota?
Oh, they were awesome. I mean, the venue we had it at was really great for it, and it would get so loud in there, and it was just a really good fight atmosphere.
And one of these fights, I believe, was the one that was on Looking for a Fighter that kind of got you noticed by Dana White and got you signed by UFC. But
yeah.
He wanted you to fight at 185. You made your debut at 185, and then you moved back up to light heavyweight. What was that conversation like trying to get back to light heavyweight after they were so set on you making that middleweight your home?
Well, there really wasn't a conversation, because I fought at 85. I got in my debut, I got knocked out or whatever, and I was like, okay, next time I'll just have to do my weight cut differently and just make it work, because I wasn't really in a position to negotiate that what weight I wanted to fight at or I didn't think I did anyways. But then they offered me the fight against Josh Stansberry. And I thought it was at 85, so I started cutting 85. Then they sent me the contract, and I was like, this is at 205. So I called my manager. I was like, what weight are we fighting at? And it ended up they wanted to fight at 205 since it was short notice. And then I won that fight, and that's been my weight class since. So
it seems like they would want people at 205. It's, a lot of people have said recently, especially that the division's kind of thinned out, like they would need names there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, and I think it was just when he saw me in Sioux Falls, when Dana saw me in Sioux Falls, I looked a little smaller. At the time, I was only walking around about 210, and just like finding that a more natural weight. So I understood why he wanted me at 85, but it's pretty much right after that fight, I had a little growth spurt, and then I was walking around about 220. So that made that cut to 85 pretty hard. And now when I'm not in fight camp, I walk around about 230. So it makes more sense for me to stay at 205. I mean, obviously I can make the weight at 85, but it's just not, I feel so much better at 205.
I want to jump in real quick. That fight and the cut, and you're talking about feeling better at 205, reminds me of, so earlier in the show, we were talking about this conversations we had with Robert Follis, Kevin Lee's coach, and he did not at all, but he said, you know, the weight cut was normal, there was nothing bad, like he had no excuses. But as a side conversation, we were talking about weight cutting, and he said, you know what, I wish, you know, we didn't have it, weight cutting, you know, he said, you know, outside of it, it's actually paraphrasing the quote here, but it's made a couple headlines. He said, outside of knockouts, which are things that just, you know, you can't really control that, outside of knockouts, weight cutting is the most dangerous thing, like, to his fighters, like the biggest health concern he has. Now, of course, you know, weight cuts could contribute to a knockout. Like, did you feel, especially the way that one went, you know, where you got touched, do you feel like, if you think about it, do you feel like the dehydration could possibly contribute to you going out?
Oh, 100%. Because it was a glancing punch. I've never been dropped besides that. And it wasn't that clean of a shot. It was just a glancing punch, and he caught me, and it wasn't anything crazy. And, you know, I was surprised as anyone else. And, you know, so I think it was a lot to do with the weight cut. The weight cut was kind of hard on me. I think I remember like a week and a half before, I was weighing 220. So it didn't, like, it was my first time cutting down 85, and it just didn't really work out that well. And maybe I didn't do it right, and that, you know, that was a thing, but it did affect me in the fight. I felt good the first 3 or 4 minutes, and then my body just started kind of shutting down on me.
How hard was it mentally? Like, going in, you're like, man, okay, I got signed by the UFC. I'm undefeated. Hey, oh, shoot, we're going to fight in, you know, it's a hometown fight in the UFC. All that positive stuff, did it make it that much harder than to, like, oh, my gosh, my first loss as a pro, and then it was in my hometown, it was in the UFC debut. You've obviously come back super strong. Like, you obviously have the mental strength to come back from. But at the time, I mean, how difficult was it for you? What was the key to get bouncing back mentally?
It was a little difficult, but the way the fight went, even though it was one round, I did really good up until I got knocked out. Yeah. So the support from the fans, pretty much everyone I talked to was like, oh, that was bull crap, that was bull crap. Because it was, I think there's like four or five seconds left too in the round, and they stopped the fight. I was still kind of moving, but it was definitely a good call. But a lot of people, they didn't agree with it, and they knew I was winning the fight, and it was kind of just like a fluke deal, you know. And that's kind of how I look at it too, as a fluke. You put me up against that Alex Nicholson again, it'll be way different, especially at 205. So it hurt a little bit at the time, but the fans, they responded good to it, and they, you know, they didn't look at me any different for losing that fight. So it was easy to come back from.
Well, you're at Jackson Week now, and you played the role of Daniel Cormier in John Jones' camp for UFC 214. How much did working day in and day out with John Jones help you, especially as a light heavyweight?
Oh, wow. It's one of those things you can't replace that, especially being in a championship fight camp. So I've been in two now, because I helped him before. I think it was it 200 where he couldn't fight, but I helped him in that camp too, and that was when I was getting ready for my debut actually. But so I've been in two championship fight camps now, and that's something that you can always take from, just, you know, what he does in that camp, and then also, you know, just the grind of it. And it really sets the pace of where I want to be, because I want to be world champion. And it really lets me know what I need to do, or just a little bit of a guideline. And then just hanging out with him, his mentality, his fight IQ is out the roof. So just all the time I got to spend with him, it greatly helped.
Did you have to work to emulate Cormier, or are you guys just kind of naturally similar?
we're kind of naturally similar, but I had to slow down and actually be, you know, just a little bit more sloppy. Because, you know, he just kind of pushes forward and, you know, a little bit of head movement, but he just pushes forward. And that wasn't really my style at all. But it was easy. I think because I knew it wasn't my style, it was easy to do. Mm-hmm. And John's a really good training partner too, so I could trust him. But I definitely had to change some things. And I had to go in there against John Jones and try to not worry about getting hit, which is a hard thing to do. But, you know, it worked out, and it turned out to be a good thing for both of us.
I heard Winkle John said that you were a better Daniel Cormier than Daniel Cormier. Is that true?
I believe it. I mean, because like I said, I don't like to get hit, and my movements are a lot different. I come in, I close the gap a lot quicker. He kind of, you know, his style is his style, and I just like to get in a little bit quicker than that, and my angles are a lot different. I don't quite stand like that. Don't dip my head quite as much, I don't think. But and if I do, I put my hands up. So
you don't drop your hands down to the side and leave the head open.
No, not against John. Not against John.
Not against John Jones.
Well, you've gotten to, you know, go through two training camps with, you know, a person that a lot of people think is the greatest MMA fighter of all time, longtime light heavyweight champion. That's got to be a good measuring stick for you, feeling where you are in the division and what you're capable of. Like, where do you, you know, do you feel like you're right there with him?
You know, it's I do, but you know, obviously there's a difference because he has the experience. He's been there and done that. I haven't done it yet, so I it wouldn't be really fair to put myself in the same category as him yet, because I haven't accomplished what he's accomplished. But being able to keep up and doing all the things, I can compete with the top guys in the division without a doubt, and I 100% believe that. And a lot of that has been gained from working with him.
Now, in the light heavyweight division, Volkan Izdemir, he's kind of risen really quickly to the title shot. He made his debut, I think, this year, maybe even.
Yep.
And he's already, you know, potentially on the cusp of getting this title shot. You're 2-0 at light heavyweight in the UFC. Do you see that maybe potentially being in your future, that you're, you know, a couple fights, some spectacular finishes, you know, some microphone work, and you could be right there in the mix too?
Oh, absolutely. The division, you know, it's not the biggest division. So you beat the right guys, knock out the right people, you're definitely moving up quick. And I'm in a really good situation right now. Jan Błachowicz, he's, what, number 15. And he's fought some really tough guys. He fought Gustafsson, Corey Anderson, Pat Cummins, Latifi. It's, you know, he's got a good streak of guys that he's gone against. And he looked good against them, too. And the thing is, none of them have finished him. So with a finish, that gives me really good leverage. And, you know, that's what we're aiming to do, is finish this guy, because no one else in the division has done it. So, you know, that'll set me apart a little bit, and that'll get me bigger fights and move us up quicker.
In the Cormier-Jones feud, you're obviously Team Jones, I'm assuming. But
yep.
Does part of you kind of see, like, rooting for Cormier to hold on to that belt so that if you get that title shot that he's the champion? Because Jackson and Winklejohn seem to have the playbook against him.
That's the only reason I'd root for him, yes. Just so I can go against him as take his belt away and bring it back to Jackson Wink. But, you know, I don't – who knows if that's going to be the case. Volkan, he's really good. So we'll see what happens there. It'll be a good fight. But I would love to fight Cormier and take his belt. That would just be the biggest thing in the world to me. But, you know, we'll see how it plays out. And, you know, it's either way, I'll take that belt from whoever. So,
how do you guys process that? I'm just kind of curious in the mindset with John being stripped again, and now Cormier is the champion again. I mean, you know, everyone views the world from their own perspective, and you guys, mm-hmm. you know, being teammates in John Jones, obviously if your guy just got finished knocking out a guy, it's going to feel strange for you all to see the guy who got knocked out be the champion. What is that? Does that add to gunning for DC? Like, I mean, how are you processing all this unfortunate stuff?
I guess that does add to me wanting to fight him and beat him. But end of the day, we all know who won those fights, and And I personally saw John train for those fights, and I know he earned those fights. So my perspective is a little bit different than some people's, but you know, it doesn't, I don't think it, for me, it doesn't take away about what he did, but definitely adds to the fire a little bit that DC doesn't really deserve that belt. He didn't earn that belt. And, you know, it wasn't really in his hands, but he does have that belt by default. So it would be, that does sweeten the pot to fight him for that.
I had one last personal follow-up from, I guess it's kind of from what we were chatting about earlier, but there was, I don't know if you guys seen this documentary called Strongman. It's on Netflix. And a guy, Eddie Hall, he just now became the world's strongest man. This takes place a couple years ago, and he's training to be the world's strongest man. You know, these crazy events where they're like pulling airplanes and all sorts of stuff, right? He's this British dude, and he talks about in his view, the difference between, I guess, what is it, arrogance and confidence. And he kind of said that, you know, arrogance is believing that you're the best in the world, and confidence is knowing you are. And he's saying, you know, you're arrogant on the way up, you know, you have the self-belief because you got to, like, I can do it, I can hang, I can do whatever. And then, but once you've actually gotten the experience and you've done X, Y, and Z, and you prove to yourself you belong there, you have, like, true confidence. I mean, clearly you're a confident man, and clearly you've probably long believed you could be and win in the UFC and go beyond just being in the UFC. When do you believe that you, like, really believed you belonged? Like, when you actually, it wasn't just like a young man's confidence, but like, no, I showed myself I can do this in the UFC.
Probably, you know, it started when I started training with John and being able to go in there and compete with John in the room. That helped with the confidence, but still, I still had to win a fight in the UFC at that point. So, really, after my last fight, I guess, is when, because then after that, that's two wins in the UFC. You know, and one win's good, but maybe it was by chance or whatever. You know, all the thoughts that go through fighters' heads with this sport, but. After the last one, I know I belong here. I know I can win. And my skill set has grown. And along with that, my confidence grows. I know that I can put the work in. I can compete in these fights and win these fights, and starting to do it where I can do it in a good fashion, start getting the knockouts and putting on these good performances. Up until this point, it's been just a good learning curve. Every fight's just a huge chance to learn, and my past two wins, they both went to decisions, but I look at that as that's just time gained in the cage, experience gained. So it's
very true.
So it's your first professional fight overseas. What kind of advice did the guys at Jackson Wink give you about traveling such a long distance for a fight, and especially when you're trying to cut weight?
You know, we haven't really dwelled on that. At the end of the day, it's still a fight, and I'm going to show up to fight either way. Biggest thing is just dealing with the jet lag a little bit, you know, not just crashing right when you get there, staying up a little bit, try to adjust to the time zone, stay active, stay focused. Weight cuts, you know, not really too much of an issue. You know, I'm sitting about 220 right now, perfect spot. I cut that weight real easy. Besides that, it's just, you know, it's another fight, you know, a little bit longer of a plane trip, but, you know, we'll deal with it and, you know, go out there and fight.
Now, I believe you were training for this camp with Marcin Tybura, if that's correct,
yeah.
Who's a Polish guy. Did he give you any kind of tips about Poland?
Just that it was really nice. You know, he, of course, he talked up his country, and no, he didn't give me any tips on Jan. I think they used to train together and they're friends and stuff, but... You know, it's professional. It's very, he's very professional about it, and he's not really picking sides. You know, me and him are teammates now. He's at Jackson Wink, so, but he's not, you know, he's not leaning one way or the other to benefit either one of us, except for, you know, giving me good practice time, you know, going hard in practice. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us. Best of luck to you in your fight. We can't wait to see it and see you inch closer to that title shot.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Wow, just amazing stuff from Devin Clark. He's a young – I don't want to call him a prospect because he has three UFC fights under
his belt. Yeah, at this point, right? Yeah, he's a UFC surging contender now.
Right.
Wow, at this point, you're right.
In a division that needs a little bit of life injected to it. You know, these are – a lot of the people you've seen in the light heavyweight division are familiar names, and this is a fresh face. And he has everything, you know, that – you wish that middleweight fight wouldn't have been forced on him because he could be an undefeated fighter right now.
Right.
Not that a one loss is anything to, you know, shake your fist at. But,
It affects your pay. It affects everything.
Yeah. Right. But the marketing of him being an look at what's worked for Volkan, that he could be that right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even with this, though, if he beats Jan, his next opponent's got to be top 10. And then if he wins that one, you could make it. At that point, all bets are off. You could get a title shot. So, you know, he's still done a great job of making up ground fast. But yeah, I agree. Yeah, it is too bad that he had to cut weight for that debut.
But, you know, all's not lost. One loss isn't a bad thing.
No, he's doing
2-0 in the division, and he's got the world in front of him. So it'll be interesting to see how his year plays out. He's, you know, working with the best, and you hear – so many fighters who go to Jackson Week talk about how much it elevates their game. And, you know, there's several of these big gyms that I think fall in that category. Team Alpha Male, American Top Team come to mind. There's a lot of gyms in SoCal that you could probably pick any of those out. Kings. Sure. But, you know, Johnny Hendricks just made the switch to go there.
Yeah.
And he said that after his first day there, he felt that this was the right decision, and he's going to do all his camps going forward there after one day. It makes sense with the amount of fighters they have there that, you know, he's training with some of the best athletes in the world, John Jones, on a regular basis. You know, that's invaluable experience you can't really get everywhere.
I think that's right. I mean, I have my very specific from afar opinions on Greg Jackson and his qualifications, but I mean, they've got bodies, they've got altitude, and they've got some great coaches. They've got Izzy Martinez, who's actually from the Chicago area. He's out there
all
the time.
He just opened a gym.
Yeah,
that's
right. Izzy style, yeah. New one, yeah, no, absolutely. They got wrestlers, but they also got, I mean, he's a top high school coach, but he's also, he's got the Izzy style MMA gym, a lot of great guys there, and he's down at Jackson Wink all the time. You know, Mike Winkeljohn himself was an incredible kickboxer, and he's from everything I hear, a really devoted and involved hands-on coach in a lot of ways. Like, they've got it's hard if you take great athletes like Devin Clark and you put them with a bunch of other great athletes, like, and you walk away, something good's gonna happen, you know, like some injuries, but some good skills are gonna develop. So you have so many top dudes like that. I understand why he and many others make that trip there, you know, like that. What other prospect that was, you know, fighting in Willowbrook 2 years ago, what other way would a prospect, was fighting Willowbrook 2 years ago get a chance to do two championship camps with John Jones? Like, if you're in the room with him, if you're there, right? So it allows guys like him apparently some really incredible opportunities.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this fight goes for him. And
that's a big one.
3-0. He's, you know, right there on the cusp and right, you know, next guy in line, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So it was great talking to him.
Yeah,
love having fighters
great.
Talk on the show, especially always appreciative when it's close to fight time for him.
So nice of him to do. He's traveling between states and continents, and he's still making time. We got to have him on afterwards for sure.
He's at home visiting his family.
And he made time for us.
And he made time for us, which means the world.
It really does. That's really cool. Thank you, Devin.
Well, that pretty much wraps up the show. Thank you for everybody who tuned in. We enjoyed talking with you all about UFC's 216. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the fight as much as we did. You can follow Extra Rounds on Twitter. We'll let you know who's going to be on the show next week, which will be same time, same place, Sports Illustrated MMA Facebook page, 3 p.m. Eastern, streaming live. And if you don't have time to watch the show live on Sports Illustrated's MMA Facebook page, you can listen to it later on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, or we'll upload the video to YouTube. So once again, thank you for everybody tuning in. We will see you next week.